This call is being recorded.
Hello, everybody. This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and we have a couple presentations today on microgrids. John Bernhardt and Larissa Dobryansky. And Larissa is going to start us out from general microgrids, talking about what she's been doing with the DOE. And then John will follow up with from the Clean Coalition discussing some community microgrid issues and projects. So go ahead, Larissa.
Thank you, Sierra. And I'm new to the group, so Sierra wanted me to kind of brief you on what I've been doing, particularly with respect to U.S. Department of Energy. And this is within its grid modernization initiative. But it places microgrid development within its smart grid program. And that's my focus. Microgrids, smart microgrids, really advanced microgrid capabilities. So I've interacted, worked with DOE within the context of their smart grid program, but the role that microgrids play in transforming the grid. And a dimension that I've brought into this as well is not only the contribution that microgrids can make to transforming our macro grid into a 21st century grid, but also concurrently how microgrids can interact between the macro grid and the community to also be shaping and transforming community energy infrastructure and the built environment. And I've worked with DOE really from the time of their American Recovery and Reinvestment Act projects to the current time, and trying to chart out a pathway for this third element, advanced microgrids, within their smart grid modernization initiative. And I've sort of been working iteratively with them, my own input on an iterative pathway that runs from how interconnection is changing, to integration, to then intelligent interconnectivity. This pathway not only for, like I said, the modernization of our grid along this pathway using smart technologies, information, communications, advanced control technologies, but specifically the role of advanced microgrids, and focusing particularly on the capabilities of microgrids, as I said, to move out of niche and into the mainstream, being endowed with advanced control, information, communications technologies, to really be an integrative agent between the macro grid upstream, the community downstream. You know, and using advanced microgrids really as tools for the macro grid and the community to manage wide and dynamic sets of distributed intermittent resources and control points, the capability of advanced microgrids to cluster compatible loads, DER units within integrated autonomous systems, and to network such systems into local energy networks within communities, and the capabilities that advanced microgrids could provide in terms of very cost-effective distributed systems control. So looking out to increasing growth of distributed resources and how advanced microgrids can become an essential tool for upstream macro grid distributed systems control and management of such proliferating distributed resources, but also looking downstream, because all of this will take place within communities, how an advanced microgrid can become a very effective tool for even developing integrated energy systems within communities. So one and the same time, enhancing homogeneous energy services, but also being able with information control technologies provide heterogeneous services, and particularly transform communities into more integrated energy systems, and looking also down the road, development of Internet of Things, and how with these capabilities, advanced microgrids could leverage data sets that span diverse facilities, systems, purposes across community and uses to interrelate, link, optimize energy using functions across diverse community infrastructure systems and the built environment. So that's, I'm working with DOE, but that these are the particular dimensions that I focus on in connection with US DOE's programs.
Oh, well, that's impressive. It sounds like you're doing a lot of really good work there. John, why don't you follow up here with
Hi, Sierra. This is Baird. I'm here.
Oh, Baird. So happy to have you back, as you're able to come. So we'll have John Bernhardt talk about what he's doing first.
John,
go ahead. Why don't you follow up after that, and I'll introduce you after John.
Okay, great. Hopefully you can hear me all right, Sierra.
We're all good, yes.
Okay, perfect. So my name is John Bernhardt. I'm Outreach and Communications Director with the Clean Coalition. Just so folks know, we're a small nonprofit, about a dozen folks based in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we do work related to planning, procurement, interconnection of distributed energy resources, and then we work collaboratively on deployments, both with municipalities, community choice aggregation firms, as well as electric utilities. So it's just a quick backdrop of who we are. You know, for the folks of today's call, I'm going to talk about our work on what we term our community microgrid initiative. So when we hear the term microgrid, I think a lot of folks just kind of have different things that pop to mind for them. And, you know, our term community microgrid initiative really has a specific focus. And what we're trying to do is prove out that within one distribution substation area, so from a substation and all the feeders that go off of it and serve end use customers within that area, we want to prove the technical and economic feasibility of generating at least 25% of annual electric load from local renewables located within that substation. So, you know, this really builds on the policy and planning work about kind of evaluating and assessing distribution grids and really trying to understand what is that methodology to look at any specific distribution substation area, find opportunities where we can maximize local generation, and that has to do both with siting potential as well as the existing grid infrastructure. Where is there ability within that grid area to site new resources? And really putting together kind of a holistic high-level view in that deployment plan that's going to optimize and maximize local generation. So, you know, this will include things like local solar, distributed PV is obviously going to be a big part of it, but where does energy storage make sense? Do we want to have kind of distributed configurations along feeders, or do we want to have a large centralized storage bank right next to the distribution substation? Where would demand response and energy efficiency come into play? Thinking about all of these technologies as kind of one complete solution and understanding and really trying to crack the code of how do we look at any particular distribution grid area and find out the best way to optimize that. So that's what our community microgrid initiative is all about, again, with the goal of proving out really high penetrations of local renewables and showing that you can bring these renewables online and do so cost effectively if you're thinking about their deployment strategically and holistically. So we have two projects that we've been working on for a number of years. The first is with Pacific Gas and Electric, and this is in the Hunters Point region of San Francisco, so kind of southeast San Francisco. There's a substation there known as the Hunters Point Substation, so this is why we call it the Hunters Point Community Microgrid Project. We've done a distribution power flow analysis of this specific distribution substation area. We've identified where the opportunities to site local renewables. We've modeled in 30 megawatts of new additional local generation and have seen that even adding that new generation, but by doing so at the right spots on the right feeders at the right locations and at the right sizes, that even without advanced inverter or smart inverter functionality, without any energy storage, we don't see any out of bounds with respect to grid stability and safety. You know, even with that additional 30 megawatts, there's no voltage issues that we've seen in our model. So we continue to work closely with engineers and staff at PG&E. Most of you know that they have a large distribution resources planning proceeding that's underway. They've started to map out their distribution grid, and just as a little aside, a lot of the methodology that they've taken into their distribution resources planning actually came out of our collaborative effort modeling the Hunters Point substation with them. So now the next step and the next challenge is, you know, part of this is really kind of transforming how utilities traditionally invest in meeting grid needs, and that's a big challenge and a big lift. So we're working with them and supporting them and encouraging them to take that next lift and create the procurement plans to bring this local solar on, but that's still underway. The other project that we have going on is out on the East Coast with PSEG Long Island, formerly known as Long Island Power Authority. And this is located out in East Hampton in a similar sort of situation, which the grid out East Hampton, as you guys would probably know, and this would make sense, is they get a huge summertime swell when it comes to population. So they have a huge summer peak, really exceeds the demand at any other point during the year. So how can we think creatively, how can we work creatively with the utility to come up with a solution that's going to meet that really high summertime peak, but do so cost-effectively? And solar PV is a great way to do that. The utility already had an existing feed-in tariff program to buy nearly 150 megawatts of local solar. So working with them to analyze the specific substation area, look at how can we drive deployment of feed-in tariff solar, maybe with some sort of locational adder to the substation area, how do we bring some energy storage online, and how can we come up with a solution that's going to meet that summertime peak in a way that's going to be cost-effective, and more cost-effective than expanding either transmission infrastructure out there or building a new gas-fired peaker plant, which are kind of the two alternative options and obviously have huge costs associated with them. So, you know, really kind of to sum it up here, you know, there's a lot of interesting opportunities, I think, in most large utility territories where they have a kind of a weak spot in the grid. They know that there's a substation area that's either due for an upgrade or deferral, an upgrade or additional generation. So we're really excited about working with utilities, on-the-ground stakeholders, regulators, to think a little bit more creatively, more holistically, and also very much from a technical perspective of how can we analyze and assess different portfolios of investments, including local renewables and other DER, and really see what's going to be that best, smartest, most thoughtful way to be investing in providing future grid services. So I'll leave it there.
Okay, that sounds like a lot of good endeavors going on, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of conversations around that after Baird talks. Baird Brown is one of my oldest members, actually, not necessarily age-wise, but he's been with me for a really long time, and is with Drinker, Biddle, and Reese. He's an attorney over there, and one of his main focuses is microgrids. So, Baird, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on? And another thing, too, is he also will be the presenter on the webinar next Tuesday on microgrids. So, Baird, please give us an overview a little bit about what's happening as far as regulatory and financing with microgrids. Just a few
sure.
minutes.
I may be among the oldest in every sense of the word. Been at this for a long time.
You don't beat me. I'll tell you that right now.
we'll draw straws later. Among other things, represent the Microgrid Resources Coalition, which is an advocacy group now affiliated with the International District Energy Association that is working to reduce barriers to implementation of microgrids wherever, sort of opportunistically, wherever there are state proceedings or, you know, particular opportunities before FERC or before the different regional transmission organizations to put our oar in the water. I'm also working with folks who are implementing microgrids, financing assets in microgrids. So on the one hand, we're doing a lot of thinking about how to eliminate barriers that prevent people from owning local generating resources or prevent people from selling electricity to their neighbors or you know, their six friends across the street or whatever it is, you know, whether it's as large as a university campus or a industrial campus, or whether it's as small as a subsection of Brooklyn. And then in the real world, while we work on, you know, making it easier, we are also devising strategies that sort of work for threading the needle to allow valuable projects to proceed in complicated regulatory circumstances. I'm going to be talking about all this next week, so I don't want to go way deeply into things, but on the one hand, we have helped the developers of the former Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. They're making a 66-acre mixed-use development, everything from sustainability research facilities to ordinary businesses, both office and sustaining the local community, and a lot of different kinds of housing. And all of that's going to be served by a microgrid and district heating and cooling that will all be centrally managed. And we sort of threaded that through the District of Columbia statutes, even though District of Columbia is in the middle of thinking about changing its regulatory approach to microgrids, but they aren't there yet. So for the Microgrid Resources Coalition, we're filing comments with the district PUC, but for the client, we were making it happen anyway. And similarly, we're working with, and this is another example I'll mention next week, something called Brooklyn Microgrid, which is not strictly speaking a microgrid at the moment. They want to eventually have included microgrids, but they're building a peer-to-peer renewable energy market amongst Brooklyn homeowners that have solar on their rooftops and other folks who'd like to buy excess generation. So they're basically replacing net metering with this peer-to-peer market, which is based on blockchain software, and is a pretty interesting process. But you know, by turning them into basically a local retail electric supplier, we are able to fit within a state law category that already exists and make that work. So our definition of a microgrid, I'm sort of doing this backward, I suppose, is really around something that has included generation and serves a lot of load, and they're not necessarily all the included load, but also has the ability to island and has the ability to sell services to the grid. And picking up on what John was talking about, one of the things we're doing is working with Lawrence Berkeley Labs and with some DOE sponsorship to help revise the Durkheim model that would allow starting to, in addition to analyze one by one these situations at the local substation, start helping to describe what the value that the microgrid is delivering to the grid, or the distributed energy resources is delivering to the grid, because in the world we hope we're going to, there's going to be a new utility business model, and California is really in the lead on this one, I think, although other people have, New York and others are doing other things, but California is thinking hard about how to make the incentives for the utilities be to accept those microgrid local generation alternatives to wires projects, and how much compensation they should get for that to sort of equalize their incentives. And I think that's an important discussion that we need to keep all working on. The other thing I'll just mention in passing is that one of the most promising things that's going on at the customer and community level is integrating energy management across thermal and electricity, at least, and possibly, you know, across water and wastewater and things as well. And that integrated management really only can happen at the customer level with somebody who has the customer's interests at heart to optimize for the customer across those different media. And to just give a simple-minded example, but it's kind of one of my poster children, is Princeton University has a five-story insulated tank in which they put chilled water using electric chillers at night when basically the pricing in PJM is around 1 cent a kilowatt hour or less sometimes because it's the nukes who have to keep running. And so it's low carbon electricity, and it's but it means that they can disperse that, they can draw on that asset, that chilled water, during the day to manage peaks on their thermal load, but they also can manage it in terms of whether they're running electric chillers during the day or not, and therefore manage their electric load, and therefore be responsive to the requirements of the grid in terms of demand response, or they actually provide frequency regulation as well. So those are the But thermal storage also goes to things like your hot water heater at home. And when there are enough of them that respond quickly, you know, they can provide services to the grid as well. So there's a whole lot going on at the grid edge that can help us reduce our collective carbon emissions and reduce the costs of the both the individual customers, to communities, and to the system, and we're excited to be involved in that.
All right. Okay, so what I'd like to do right now is just kind of introduce a few of the folks who are online, and if I miss you, it's because some of your names haven't shown up, so please identify yourself. We have Josh Valentine from Clean Coalitions online here, and Chris Carrick, is that you?
Hi, Sierra.
Okay, hi. This is Central New York Regional Planning Board. Cleaner Rob from Christian and Barton, attorney over there in Virginia. Craig Lewis, is that you online here?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Craig, also from the Clean Coalition. And Dwayne Baker was here earlier. Bernardino O'Neill called Council of Governments. Is that correct, Dwayne?
That's right.
Okay. Evan Hughes is a consultant with Biomass Energy and Geothermal Energy. Jen Hill, I think that's you from Upper Peninsula Association of County Commissioners. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. John Walter, Repower Yolo. Is that you?
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
Cool. Good to have you, John. It's been a while.
Thank you.
Glad to
yep.
see you're still around. I
yep.
think about you frequently, actually. Michelle Halfell from Pennsylvania State Community and Sustainable Communities over in Pennsylvania. Is that
yeah.
you, I assume?
Yep.
Is
I'm
that
here.
Ron Ron Kamen? Is that you? Earthkind
yes,
Energy?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Hi. All right. And let me know if I missed anybody. As an unknown caller, I'm not sure who that is. Sometimes Evan logs in through Skype, and I can't tell.
I called
That's
in on
probably
the
probably me again.
I'm oh, is that you, Evan?
David Keg,
or
no?
Oh, David. Oh, cool. All right. So we have. Yeah, I saw you on the other line, Evan. So, David, you're online. I'm glad to see you. Okay, good. So that's the roster right now. Feel free to go ahead and ask these folks questions. Anybody?
This
sure
is Evan.
Hey.
I'm interested in the business model. It sounded from Baird Brown's presentation like in one case. A utility might actually be a new business beyond wires, he said, and be the organizer of the microgrid services. And the other case, the Princeton one, I suspect it's either the university or a third party who's organized that project. So I'm interested in the role of the utility, especially how a third party comes in and does this in association with the residents or industry or whoever has the equipment or uses on the microgrid.
Sure. It sounds from your question like I wasn't sufficiently clear before, but let's, and again, I'll do more of this next week, but at one end of the spectrum is Princeton University, 1 meter, 2 meters actually, two substations actually, although they're trying to collapse that. And they get to manage everything, you know, from their dashboard on their campus. And they have a lot of private industry partners that are helping them in various ways, but they're very much managing the whole process. And if you're Princeton, they're not richer than God, but they're not short of money to do interesting things that ultimately save them money. The storage tank I described to you saves them $1 million a year on a $20 million energy bill. At the other end is what San Diego Gas and Electric did at Borrego Springs, where they had a community at the end of a long feeder that was not highly reliable. And they went in and, you know, put in islanding equipment for the community. And I think there's a bunch of both storage and local generation. I think for the most part, they own some of the storage. I think mostly the generation is locally owned, but they organized making the community more resilient. And it basically is an extension of their mission as a distribution company. And so that and it serves the whole community, and it sort of, you know, they're not trying to co-manage these other kinds of loads that I was talking about that Princeton, for example, is heavily involved in. Then you get, there are lots of spaces in between. On the one hand, the Brooklyn example I was talking about, you're going to have an entity that's buying and selling electricity and ultimately hopefully generating some and having local pocket microgrids, but they're just taking advantage of the electric retail electric supplier statute called ESCOs in New York, where they can directly sell to retailers over to retail customers over the utility's own wires. And they don't even really need to make a special deal with the utility to do that, because that process of being a retail electric supplier is all set up in the state statute. At another point in the interaction, again, an example I'll bring up next time, Duke the utility is proposing to build a cogen plant on the campus of Duke the University, and it will basically run the cogen as a generator that's part of its system, and it's in a group of states where it's still allowed to own generation, unlike a lot of the rest of us, and so it's that generator just becomes part of their system. It's financed through their typical utility finance arrangements, and it sells thermal energy to the university at favorable rates. What that doesn't do is allow, you know, any of the kind of campus integrated management that I was describing at Princeton. But realistically, the utility couldn't do that because it can't, you know, it's invested its ratepayer money in this generating asset. It has to run it to optimize its grid. It can't run it to optimize Duke's campus. So you have to think about what utilities are allowed to do and what they can meaningfully do, which is not support customers that have multiple goals that aren't necessarily the reliable operation of the system for everybody's benefit. And
we probably need to move on to another question here. We've got a huge group of people today, or huge, I guess, relatively speaking. So somebody else had a question here. Dive in. Come on, guys. Don't be shy.
I'll ask one.
Do you want to identify yourself, please, first?
Oh, John Walter, West Coast. So my question is really twofold. One is there's a lot of discussion around microgrids. And I'm trying to understand, what is the definition of the size of a microgrid in terms of this distribution of load and the composition? Is there such a thing, for example, as a picogrid?
Anybody?
I'll offer something, yeah. You know, I think now there have been, I work in India also relating to US DOE activities, and I think there is starting to go down the wrong road if you're looking at size in terms of definition of microgrids. It really is better to think in terms of functionalities. And you're hearing quite a range in this discussion alone. Think in terms of functionalities and how the description of the functionalities differentiates the microgrid from technology-specific applications like solar PV or even aggregations like a virtual power plant. So as was mentioned, I think Baird gave a good concise definition. I'm looking at building more intelligence, though, like I said, advanced capabilities to extend the functionalities, but the basic definition is, you know, interconnecting loads, DER and storage within a defined boundary that acts as a single controllable entity with respect to the macro grid, can island, connect, disconnect from the grid. And I think it's best to look at the functionalities. In terms of size, microgrids can run from even a building scale all the way up, you know, to 60, 70, 80 megawatts. But I think a lot of the projects are telling us that you need a certain size to support economic viability. And it may not be the largest sizes that would be the way to go either. Might need more modularity. And so to develop microgrid cells, you know, dispersed that logically cluster generation, load, you know, energy resources, and then networking them. So size has not been the driving, you know, criterion for the definition. But size is relevant when it comes to, of course, the economic viability and kind of the strategic configuration of the grid within a community, within a service territory.
A quick question. What's the size of substations?
And who is this? Please identify yourself.
This was Evan trying to get John Bernhardt.
Evan,
to
let's give a chance for somebody else to ask a question here, Evan, because we have a lot of people today. So we need to take turns here on the questions. Anybody else have a question? Do you presenters have questions for each other?
Oh, one thing. I just want to say, hi, Craig Lewis. This is Larissa. Haven't connected with you for a long time, but I have followed Clean Coalition's work and great projects.
Awesome, Larissa. It was wonderful to hear your voice. I didn't hear your name called off on the round, Robin, but I heard you comment earlier. It was great to hear your voice. Thank you for the comment, and hello to you.
It seems like there's a lot of topics that could be broken down under this whole general umbrella of microgrids. So one of the things I'd like to look at is, in the future here, taking it down into problems and what kind of issues.
Could I offer just one commentary, because I'll sort of create my own question and answer here. But, you know, in what I've described, I'm looking further down the horizon, but it isn't divorced from the projects that's been, you know, that have been described by John and Baird. It's how do you, what's kind of the value of looking down the horizon? And I just want to put in a plug for doing that in terms of USDOE's work. A lot of times, I think based on past practice, we tend to look at microgrids as very, very customized and not even susceptible of standardization. But to go back, I think Baird said it well in terms of looking to microgrids for functions that are quite differentiated from what a grid can do. Because I'm already seeing, you know, in terms of some grid modernization efforts, how there still is this proclivity for control and getting behind the meter. And I think we should, you know, think in terms of comparative advantages, what the grid can do the best versus what a microgrid, advanced microgrid, can do the best. And he mentioned, and I also described this earlier, integrated energy management. And this is a particular comparative advantage of a microgrid and even an advanced microgrid. But to be able to make these microgrids economically viable, they can't be just sheerly customized. They have to have a certain level of standardization in terms of their functions. And so that's a particular value I just want to point out of U.S. Department of Energy's work to develop them as dynamic integrative agents in terms of the ways in which they could interact, interoperate with the macro grid on the one hand, but equally really come out of controlled environments and into the dynamic terrain of communities to interact, to be able to help communities evolve these integrated energy systems where you're really optimizing the use of energy across end uses, whether, as Baird said, waste, water, transportation, et cetera. And that these are particularly excellent functionalities for microgrid development as distinguished from, you know, grid modernization. And what DOE is trying to do is to develop those levels of standardization that could support really economically these functions for communities, and doing it in terms of standards development, how microgrids can be developed to be grid compatible and interactive upstream, as well as with the communities within which they are operating and have developed integrated energy operations amongst their constituent loads, generation elements, to develop the protocols that would govern, you know, this interaction between the microgrids and the grid. And I do suggest, pivotal to all of this is the standardization of the specifications for the microgrid controller. And an excellent issue just came out recently, the summer issue for IEEE, on all that's going on in standardizing the microgrid controllers. And it's this level of standardization that can take, I believe, microgrids out of niche, singularly niche applications, and move them into the mainstream. They still will be, of course, geared to customizing the way in which they operate within communities and with their customers, but it will enable really moving to more plug and play and moving them into more standardized role in the way they function and interrelate to the macro grid upstream and the community downstream.
I'd like to get a comment from John, Craig, or Baird. And Ron, do you have any involvement with microgrids at all, Ron Kamen?
Yeah, I actually I did a one for a city in New York where I got them a $100,000 grant, and they are now moving through the process with New York Prize, which is New York State's program to encourage microgrids. The challenge always becomes just how do you define the area, how do you deal with the existing utility infrastructure, how do you interface with that, how do you make it cost-effective? So I'm really kind of curious how folks have been able to do that cost-effectively throughout the country, and if someone can comment, that would be great.
Yeah, John, Baird, or Craig, do you have any comments on that?
But this is Baird. I mean, cost effectiveness has an awful lot to do with particular geographies and particular, you know, tariffs and everything else that you're operating under. And it's a sort of a new whole experiment that we're doing with things like the New York Prize or the New Jersey, you know, town center microgrids and so forth, that you create a microgrid from scratch, and as opposed to sort of growing it over time, like most of the existing examples are. I'm not sure there's a good simple answer to that, but I think what John suggested is that, you know, looking for the places. You look on the one hand for the thermal load, and you look on the other hand for the place on the distribution system that needs help. And usually, you ought to be able to find economic places to locate. One brief comment on what Larissa said: I completely agree that moving forward to Exelon calls them clustered microgrids. The ability of microgrids to sort of support each other locally and have utilities do distributed semi-autonomous controls, so it works more like packet switching on the internet than it does like a central control room that has to say, you know, now you do this, now you do that, is, I think, one of the huge things that we should hope utilities are going to be doing instead of trying to own everything behind everybody's meter.
Hi.
Yeah,
who is the manager? Go ahead. Identify yourself, please.
Sure. This is Joe Bernhardt from Clean Coalition. I'm just going to chime in real quickly about.
Yes.
I think the cost effectiveness point is a really good one. What Baird said. You know, I think in our opinion, definitely alludes to some critical components, right? So looking at upcoming needed investments, either on the transmission or distribution side, and thinking about where in those particular locations and geographies we can start to pinpoint and target kind of larger scale substation area demonstration projects that are going to do a better job generating and balancing power locally and kind of easing future needs for investment either in new generation or transmission infrastructure to serve those particular areas, I think is kind of a really critical point that we think a lot about as we're talking with utilities and trying to identify areas that are prime candidates for community microgrids. And I think the other key piece here for cost effectiveness is, you know, I think when a lot of people hear microgrids, there's certainly kind of an initial reaction that it's going to be behind the meter on what's probably a larger, sophisticated commercial or industrial customer. And I think that's definitely the bulk of what we have seen. And there tends to be a lot of kind of continued niche deployment in that market. But I think one area that we see a lot of opportunity, I think utilities are really interested in, is how do we bring some of the benefits of distributed energy resources to the broader grid, right? Rather than benefiting just a singular customer, how can we structure actual configurations of community microgrids in a way that, you know, for 99.99% of the time when the grid's in regular operation, they can be providing grid services that are going to be benefiting all customers across utility service territory by deferring costs and providing a cost-effective solution. And in our mind, one kind of key piece of that is kind of getting away from this, I think, almost unilateral focus on behind the meter and thinking about how can we bring resources to the wholesale side of the meter and giving the utility the opportunity to maybe control and operate the battery to experience integrating and managing that and using it for a whole suite of different purposes, which is a little bit harder to do when it's behind a customer's meter and they're just going to use that to optimize their own energy bill. And then the other piece is even local generation does not necessarily need to be net metered. How can we think about procurement program design like a feed-in tariff or a value solar tariff that's going to bring that out to the wholesale side of the meter, give the utility a little bit more visibility and control. They're going to buy that power. They're going to be able to manage that power in concert with, you know, maybe advanced inverters, maybe energy storage to be reducing, you know, expensive wholesale costs, you know, reducing stresses and strains on the grid. You think about the California duck curve. That's really just an aggregation of a bunch of distribution substation areas all peaking at the same time. So if we can start to address those on a one-by-one basis and stamp that out, there's going to be a lot of beneficial and cost-saving opportunity across much larger grid areas.
I got the one reaction, and I guess also teeing off of your final words. One-by-one is good in terms of pilots, but here I think we're really talking about standardization and the importance of it. Because to achieve cost effectiveness, we have to have standard unified methods in which to measure the benefits. And I think DOE, FERC, states, this is what they're looking to. And really, what as distributed energy resources are increasing market penetration, what's the nature of their impacts, and also how can we, in a standardized way, capture the net benefits of these resources, not just in terms of, like you said, the customers that like a microgrid would be serving, but in terms of the grid. So that's one area, valuation, and then how placing the utilities in a position where they can actually compare the distributed resource options against one another versus, you know, as alternatives to conventional options. Another arena, again, for standardization, too, is what kind of changes will need to be made at the distribution systems level to be able to cost effectively capture these benefits, even after you evaluate and determine that the distributed option would be more cost effective than the traditional. So there's a lot of reconfiguration that, and thinking about grid architecture, I think all of you probably know Jeff Taft has been doing excellent work for DOE and his whole entourage there. And also, of course, a big one, how we, you know, so much of the focus has been on economic regulation within state proceedings, but more attention has to be given to how to change markets. Their pricing, their structures really doesn't match tapping into the fuller potential of these resources for the grid.
Evan, go ahead, Baird.
When you're done, I'd like to bring Evan back in for a question. But go ahead, Baird.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, I agree in part with Marissa and Larissa, and perhaps disagree a little bit. I think the point about markets is exactly right. And the way that the current markets, that is to say the RTO markets, achieve standardization is not by trying to standardize all the equipment that's out there, but having standardized products. And then the, you know, whoever wants to do a microgrid can say, okay, I can provide regulation, or I can provide reserves, or I can provide whatever it is, and I'm going to configure my equipment to meet the requirements of that market. And if you're in the market, then you're visible to the grid operator, and they can call on you when you want. And that's one way of achieving that. The other way is through a sort of a RFP and long-term contracting process. I'm a distribution company. I've got a substation that needs help. I know I'm going to need certain kinds of things to get that help, and I can contract for that from the local microgrid. So I think it's more about standardizing the product than it is about standardizing the controls.
I'd like to bring Evan back in again. One second here. Larissa, 1 second here. Let me have Evan get a chance to ask his question, then we'll get back to that.
Oh, I was just asking what Baird meant by standardizing control. I'm not sure I understood that.
Controls. I mean, in having a standard microgrid controller is less important than having, you know, the ability for people to deliver the services that the grid requires and have the grid.
Well, on that, though, there's physicality. And no, if the microgrid isn't standardized in a way to be grid compatible and interactive, then the microgrid is not going to be able to deliver the services to the utility in the regularized, obligated, and committed way that utilities are used to receiving it. So that's the importance.
I think we're talking past each other. There's a lot of there's a lot of effort by certain large companies to say my microgrid controller runs everything, and there's a lot of pushback saying, no, you need a lot of different systems. Obviously, it has to integrate with the utility.
Just one last
okay.
comment on
let,
that.
Let me
take a look at
Let me move to Evan here. Evan, you had a question.
I just wanted a quick kilowatt size of a substation.
What was that now?
Kilowatt or megawatt size of a typical substation.
Okay. Somebody, anybody, John or somebody?
I think that there's going to be, at least my experience, and Craig could probably chime in with way more expertise and insight than I can, but there's a lot of variability depending on the location and just the design of the substation, like the Brooklyn Queens substation. I know that substation, they were looking to shed 52 megawatts worth of load, which means that it was serving even more than that. Craig, I know that you can talk about the size, I think, both Hunter's Point and the GT substation out in East Hampton.
Okay. Anybody else? Any other comments here?
Yeah, this is Craig. I'm sorry. I've had a couple other things that I've had to be dealing with, so I'm sorry I missed some of the conversation. I'm not in a position to respond to John's queuing me up there. Sorry.
Remember offhand the size of the Hunter's Point substation? In terms of
Load. That had an average load on it of about, I believe it was right around 10 megawatts average load. So that's average. Peaked at something on the order of 20 megawatts, and but average was around 10.
Thank you.
Sierra, this is Jen Hill. I have a question.
Sure.
So I'm up in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, 15 counties, 300,000 people total. And the microgrids are of immediate relevant to us as we rely almost extensively on transmission. And this intuitively seems to make sense that we need to be moving in this direction of the dependence that we have on one or two wires than failing. And so in recognition of that, the Michigan passed an energy law in December. We now have integrated resource plans being mandated, and we're going to get a separate scenario just for the Upper Peninsula that looks potentially at the loss of load of 20% load loss as customers are potentially leaving the grid because of high prices or big either a mine or a big mill shuts down. And so it's absolutely fascinating to hear all of this and think about how it would allow the flexibility to have this decentralization. I just think we're in a position to integrate this technology if we can get past the capital costs and some of these changes. So I'm wondering if folks at the Borrego Springs, which I had heard of, are there other rural examples that folks are aware of where this kind of stuff is happening?
John Walter, any comments?
Sorry, I had mute. That was one of the reasons for my question earlier about sort of sizing, and I appreciate the load explanation. Out here in California, there's, of course, a tremendous effort move the control of supplying energy to city-level and county-level institutions. And so, many of the counties are trying to separate from their main utilities and create their own supply network. They would still use the distribution services from the utilities. So there is discussion at the very early stage, but nobody in these local governments, other than just sort of framing it, has moved forward to any kind of discussion on, you know, how to move forward with some microgrids. And we have counties. The county I'm in has got about 500,000 people, but spread among four cities, and quite a bit of rural, large energy use of farmers with large energy use. It's almost a perfect environment for some tests. It's not as isolated as Hunter's Point, and also not quite as convenient. But it's a long way of saying, to my knowledge, nothing's been moved forward at all. There's sort of recognition and some people that are working behind the scenes on microgrids. But until some of these local distribution, or I'm sorry, supply centers get off the ground, before that happens, there's really very little action that's going to take place other than sort of the experimental work that's sort of been discussed.
Dwayne, do you have anything to do with microgrids over there?
No, not really.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure you weren't excluded from the conversation, but go ahead. Somebody was about to answer on that.
Well, it was Jen. I had a follow-up. I thought of my other point, which is it does seem like there's a lot of opportunities for municipal utilities here, particularly on that integration question and standardizing it. Here I represent UP Association of County Commissioners. The standardization opportunities for government services seems tremendous, and honing in on the municipal utilities as that vehicle is an interesting idea as well.
Yeah, this is Baird Brown. The municipal utilities have a huge opportunity in this arena, especially the ones that are transmission dependent, as it's called, and sort of alleviating that dependence. If you're talking, and I'm not talking from real world examples, but if you're talking about the kind of situation that was described in I take it Northern California, or in any event, in comparatively rural California, you're looking at being able to take individual small communities, or even parts of them, and making microgrids out of them. Very difficult to really make microgrids out of dispersed rural population. But having said that, if you have some slides that I'll have next week, if you have more distributed generation in a network pattern rather than one feeder and distant units, you can have much more reliability for the folks in the surrounding rural areas, even without them being literally part of the microgrid.
Thank you.
This is John, just to chime in quickly. I mean, I think that there is definitely a huge opportunity for maybe rural situations in which there's either less reliability or a higher cost to serve, and particularly for publicly owned utilities or municipal utilities to step in here and think about ways that they can support the development of more local generation, and then, you know, pair that with even a battery or two. It'd be exceedingly expensive to island the entire community, but if it's a rural community, a small town with a main street, can you design it as such as though that you have, distributed PV and storage there that for the most part are providing benefits in terms of deferring expensive power from coming off that transmission system, saving the public utility money, but also have the capability from design from the get-go to provide that resilience into at least an island or provide continual power for, say, a community facility in the case of a larger outage, which there's going to be some community shared shelter that has power, and you can do so much more cost-effectively than trying to island the entire community. Just those key facilities or key couple of facilities.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and end it now.
Can I add one thing to that? Check NRECA, doing very creative things, combining not only what's been discussed here, but with telecommunications and cloud-based technologies.
Okay, That sounds good. All right, so this is recorded. I'll have the recording up in a few days here, probably early next week. And thanks, everybody, for attending. And one of the things I like to think about is problems and taking one of these problems one at a time and find out what all of you have been working on in the way of solutions so those can be shared, because obviously it's a broad field. So thanks again, and hope to see you next time. Don't forget about Baird's webinar next Tuesday. It should be a good one.
Thanks.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you all.
Bye now.